This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli of TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. After editing the satirical news magazine The Onion and writing the screenplay for the film The Wrestler, Robert Siegel wrote and directed the movie Big Fan, which stars the comedian Patton Oswalt. Big Fan was one of Entertainment Weekly's top 10 films of 2009 and will be released next week on DVD. Both Siegel and Oswalt spoke with Terry last year when the film was originally released and are our guests today. Patton Oswalt co-starred in the TV sitcom The King of Queens and was the voice of Remy the Rat in the animated film Ratatouille. Big Fan is Oswalt's first dramatic role. He plays Paul Offiero, who's a regular caller to his favorite sports talk radio station, where he's known as Paul from Staten Island. Outside of his obsession with the New York Giants, his life is drab. He's 35, but still lives with and constantly quarrels with his mother. He has one friend, and he spends his day in a glass booth working as a parking garage attendant. But Paul's insular world is disrupted when he spots on the street the player he most idolizes, Quantrell Bishop. Paul sees this as his big chance to show his hero how much he cares about the team, but as a result of a misunderstanding, Quantrell turns on him, brutally. Still, Paul remains a fan. Here's a scene from the film. Paul is calling into the sports show, occasionally reading from his carefully handwritten notes. It's late at night, and in the middle of the call, he's interrupted by his mother in the next room, who thinks he's wasting his time and his life.
Hey, Paul from Staten Island.
Hey.
What we got tonight?
Hey, what's up, dog? I gotta tell you, I am feeling good tonight, because in a little less than 48 hours, we are gonna brutally shatter any flicker of hope the cheesesteaks had going. We've been messing with them the last few weeks, letting them get back in it a little, making them think they had a chance of catching us, just so we can see the look on their faces when they come up short. Quantrell's back, baby, and he is good. Quantrell is back, baby, and he is ready to make up for some lost time against the Panthers. You better hope the scoreboard is broken down there in St. Louis, because the Eagles are going to be so crushed when they look up at it and see the Giants-Panthers score, they're not even going to be able to play. It's not even going to come down to the head-to-head in Week 17. We're going to wrap up the East in a nice little bow this coming... Sorry. This coming weekend, after which we will follow our predestiny to the Super Bowl as we ride the victory bus to the championship. And why are we riding in the victory bus to a championship we haven't played? Because, as I said earlier, it is predestiny that we will take the Super Bowl this year, while at the same time waving goodbye to the Eagles.
Thanks, Paul. Now that's a G-Men fan.
Oh,
thanks,
thank you.
Buddy.
All right, okay. Thanks, sports dog. Thank you.
Robert Siegel, Patton Oswalt, welcome to Fresh Air. Robert Siegel, have you listened to a lot of sports talk radio, and did you ever call a station yourself, even as research for this movie, just to see?
Have I ever been a long-time listener, first-time caller?
Yes, exactly.
First-time caller, long-time exactly. Listener? No, I've purely, my experience has purely been voyeuristic. I've never called in. I grew up listening to sports radio. I still listen to it, but as a kid, I listened to it pretty obsessively every single night. When I went to bed, I would crawl under the covers and turn out the light and stay up way past my bedtime. And listening to WFAN, the air would fill with these voices of Murray from Flushing and Vinny from Rigo Park and Doors from Yonkers and whatnot. And I was this Jewish Long Island kid in my sort of middle class suburb, and I would hear these voices from sort of far off exotic corners of the New York City area that I'd never really been to, and you couldn't help but wonder what their lives were like.
What did you think of Patton Oswalt for the role of the fan?
Why did I think of him?
Yeah, I mean, he's best known as a comic and as an actor in comedies. This is not a comic film. It's not a comic performance.
No. I didn't do it. And, sometimes comedians are cast in dramatic roles in ways that feel like stunt casting. Look at the you know, look at the funny clown. He's really sad inside. I just thought he was right. I just thought he really felt right for the role. He looked right. He was the right age.
What does looking right mean?
Yeah, what does looking right mean, Robert?
Can I let Patton take
No, you can't.
You know, I thought if he we discussed it, and he said he was willing to bulk up for the role and stay out of the sun. He had a pretty healthy, glowing tan at the time, and he promised that he would go method and stay in his basement for a few months to kind of get rid of that.
Yeah, I laid off the mixed martial arts for about 9 months so, and really got doughy.
I thought if he would go through a you know, very advanced, aggressive anti-tanning process and then you know, and then hit some Lucky Charms. we could get him into shape. No, I just thought, Patton, may I insult you?
Go right ahead.
Okay. I just thought he looked like he could be a an obsessive, you know, nerdy sports fan. Is that fair?
That's fair.
Okay. Yeah, you know, and I also thought, honestly, on a practical level, you know, It was a very low budget movie, and I didn't think that Philip Seymour Hoffman or Paul Giamatti would be willing to. I'd be getting reamed out by their managers every night when they found out that I didn't supply them with a chair to sit in, things like that. So I knew I couldn't get you know, those two guys.
Patton Oswalt, now that we know that you come cheap,
I come cheap.
Not come anymore. Cheap. We this.
Thanks for jumping in, Robert.
That will change now.
Yeah. Well, your performance is really terrific in the film. I mean, you really capture the kind of the loneliness and frustration and disconnection and kind of anger and niceness of this of this character. What did you think about the role when you were offered it? Did you say, yeah, that's perfect for me? Was that your first reaction or was it something else?
Well, when I read the script itself, I loved how it was written, that style of writing, which, because I'm such a film buff and love all those movies from the early 70s, those sort of difficult character studies. Do you know what I mean? Stuff like Fat City and King of Marvin Gardens, and I really miss that kind of writing and filmmaking. So there was this – I had mixed feelings because on the one hand, this is a very dark – very, very messed up character, but as a guy who loves watching movies, this was the kind of movie that I'd always dreamed of being in at one point in my career. After a very short consideration, I had to say yes.
Are you a sports fan?
No, I absolutely have. Not only am I a sports fan, I'm not a sports fan to the detriment of the movie of a couple of the scenes in the movie when. Me and Kevin Corrigan, who plays my best friend, were supposed to riff about sports. And Robert found out very early on that we don't have any sports knowledge. So we would start improvising. And I mean, I'm not exaggerating. 5 seconds into it, we would both just stop because we had nothing. Well, that's the extent of our sports knowledge.
You would run out of sports terminology very quickly.
And then I would get scared and I would make stuff up. It literally made no sense. Like, you think Bronco's going to go 500 on the blue level? And cut, what? What did you say? It made no sense.
He knows the terms touchdown and ball.
Which I'm pretty sure are golfing terms.
You know, in the movie Big Fan, you know, Paul, the main character, mm-hmm. Patton Oswalt's character, he works in a garage, but he defines himself by his love of football and of the Giants, but also he's Paul from Staten Island. He's the guy who calls into the station. And this is who he is. He's Paul from Staten Island, the guy who calls in to the sports talk show. Mm-hmm. And when he calls in, he writes down on a yellow pad what he wants to say. Mm-hmm. And he either reads it or at least he refers to it during the call. And I thought that was so perfect that this call, and like he pretends like it's all being improvised, but this mm-hmm. so defines who he is that he has to get it exactly right. I mean, it's his work. It's his like it's his thing.
He does it partially as a crutch, I think, because he's afraid he'll forget what he wants to say, or he'll think of some. You know, he's locked in this parking booth all day with nothing but his thoughts and. He thinks of all these great things to say, and I think he just has to write them down because he's afraid he's going to forget it. And then it's even more than that; it's his art, you know. It's this is what he was kind of meant to do, you know.
I almost see it in his own twisted way. He's a guy that his calling in at night is he's a musician with a day job. Where I have to work at a Denny's during the day, but at night I go out and rip it up. I'm an amazing guitarist. So in his mind, these calls are his performances that he has to prepare for, if you will.
Yeah, and you know, a lot of people think that it's pathetic that he's so obsessive about sports. But the thing is, if he were at the level where he could turn that into being a sports writer or a sportscaster or set up a really successful sports blog, it would be a passion that he could actually make a living at. You know, people always draw the lines. You know what I mean? They draw the line between the passion where you can't make a living and the passion where you can.
Yeah, but, you know, I've met a lot of, you know, because I'm very into comic books and a huge bookworm and film buff. So I've gone down to, like, the San Diego Comic-Con, and I have met versions of Paul Alfiero. He made his own Klingon costume, and he actually got every single detail perfect. And I was talking to him, and I said, "Wow, what do you do? Are you a costume designer?" And he said, "No, I do, risk assessment for an insurance company or something during the day." And I said, "Well, you could clearly be a costume designer on a show." And he looked at me, it had this look like if I worked on the show, I wouldn't have time to watch the show that I like. It's almost like they don't want to follow their passion that far because then I wouldn't have time to worship this thing. And also, I might not want to see that much behind the scenes. I want it to be this from on high, almost supernatural thing that I worship. So he gave me that look like, that's ridiculous. That's I work during the day, and then this is what I do, and I never miss my show.
That's a really interesting way of looking at it, that what's required here is the ability to worship something at somewhat of a distance.
That's why I think that Paul is always sitting out in the parking lot watching on that little TV. He's the
kind of... Yeah, well, let's describe what you mean. He goes to the stadium, but rather than buying a ticket, and I don't know if he can't afford it or it's sold out, but he...
It's just hard to get Giants tickets.
Yeah, so he watches it in the parking lot with a little TV plugged into the... plugged into the car, yeah.
But I mean, I was
giving advice to the team about what they should be doing. Of course,
exactly. yelling at a TV while he's inhaling fumes from his car. But I almost feel like he's one of those acolytes, if you will, that it would be insulting to his team if he was part of the mass in the stadium just mindlessly yelling. He almost sees the people in the stadium as like, these are the Pharisees that just want to worship in public, and I want to go to the quiet place and commune with my God. It's almost like I'm better than all the riffraff in there. They're not true fans like me.
Like when you go to a Super Bowl party, you know, sometimes you can get vaguely annoyed that everybody, all these, women... people who normally don't watch football every week.
They're just there for the Super Bowl.
Yeah, and they're jumping on the bandwagon one night a
year. How dare you?
And they're excited about the commercials, and it's sort of vaguely insulting, and you kind of want to just get away and watch alone in your room where you can really focus on, the things that matter.
There's a couple of things in Big Fan that remind me of Scorsese films. As for Taxi Driver, and Taxi Driver, the De Niro character is kind of in the world but cut off from it because he's always in a cab. He's always in this like little coffin-like cab driving through the streets, disconnected from everything and looking at it through the taxi. And Paul, Paul, the character in Big Fan, is in a booth and he sees all these people driving by, but he's enclosed in this glass booth. But it's also a lot like King of Comedy, where the De Niro character is sitting alone in his basement, living with his mother. And in his basement, he has like cardboard cutout characters of the people he idolizes, like Liza Minnelli.
Right, he's got the wall with the laughing audience.
And he imagines he's talking to them on the set of The Tonight Show. And he has this really elaborate fantasy world with the people he idolizes, which is not unlike Paul's life idolizing his sports fans. Were you thinking of these movies?
I love both those movies, and I tried my hardest not to overtly rip them off. I'm very excited and happy that you're reminded of both of those.
Yeah.
They certainly are two. Scorsese is my favorite director, and those
mine too.
Two are is he?
He really is.
Oh, I don't know. For me, pretty much. from Mean Streets to King of Comedy is the greatest run any director's ever had.
Well, you know, you mentioned Taxi Driver, and you know, Taxi Driver, that movie can almost be watched in a loop because the very last image is of the empty rearview mirror, and that which is also the very first image. We just come full circle that this guy is going to ride around in this cab until the rage builds up, and he's going to explode again, and it's just going to happen in this endless cycle. And not to give anything away about Big Fan, but it struck me there's an image, there's a very specific image at the end. When you talk about this guy is in a booth and then he communicates with the world by calling in on a telephone, and there's an image at the end that now he's actually gone even further into that world.
Oh, my God. I didn't even realize that.
You know, yeah.
That wasn't
I figured that wasn't intentional.
No, but that's great.
His one – you'll see what I mean when you see the movie. There's an image at the end.
I didn't even realize I did.
Yeah,
that.
Where even now his one friend has been relegated to the other world. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And
I hope somebody writes that.
Yeah, someone better. I'll write it under a pseudonym somewhere.
Okay.
But I loved that aspect of and the one thing about Paul, comparing him again to Travis Bickle. Travis Bickle in his voiceovers does long to connect with the world. He says very specifically, "I don't think you should, you know, spend your life in what is it?
Morbid self-attention.
Morbid
self-attention. You should try to be a what is it? You try to be a person like other people.
A person like other people.
Other
person
people.
Like other people.
And Paul, for all of his faults, and he has a lot of faults, he does not desire to reach out to anyone. He is actually non-judgmental in his.
I don't think of him as being
isolation.
Complex and conflicted as
no,
he's
not
Travis Bickle.
He's not a yearning God's lonely man. He, if anything, his battle is to keep the world away from him. That's his heroic battle, is when the world sent its tendrils in to try to pull him out into the wider world, he's fighting them off.
If he could just be left alone, I think he would be happy. I think he's a happy guy.
My guests are Robert Siegel and Patton Oswalt. Robert Siegel wrote the movie The Wrestler, and he wrote and directed the new movie Big Fan, which is about a really obsessive sports fan whose main interest in life is calling in to the sports talk radio station. And the role is played by Patton Oswalt.
And if I may give the log line of the movie, is that what they call it?
Yeah, log line, one sentence.
Yeah. The way it will eventually be described in TV Guide magazine, with any luck. Obsessive sports fan gets beaten up by his favorite player is the hook of the movie.
Yeah, I wasn't sure how much to give away. So let's
You can give that away.
Let's go there.
That's the premise.
Yeah. So he gets beaten up by his favorite player. He, you know, you were talking about how worshipful he is and how he wants to keep this all at a distance so he can worship it until he actually runs into his main object of worship. And then he follows him to a bar, a strip club, basically.
Gentleman's
bar, yes. And then has to figure out, well, what does he do? So he offers to, like, he sends a drink over. Like, the guy's going to be really impressed with that. Like, he needs a fan to buy him a drink.
Right.
It's so kind of all wrong, his expectations. Like, he's so removed. But to not give too much away, the football player ends up beating up the fan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then the fan has to decide.
The bulk of the movie is how does he deal with the emotional fallout of the fact that the thing that he's built his whole life around has literally and figuratively punched him in the face.
Yeah, that's a good way to question. I mean, look, if you're a tormented Christian who's frustrated with the God who will not answer, be happy that he doesn't answer you, because this is what happens when the God you worship answers you sometimes.
There was that Onion story years ago.
Which you edited. Yeah, go ahead.
God finally, yes. I'm going to misquote it, but it was God finally answers prayers of, what was it? Answers prayers of little boy?
Something like that.
And then the subhead is no, says God.
The other one I love was God diagnosed as bipolar.
God diagnosed with bipolar disorder.
Yeah, bipolar disorder. Like, wow, this guy's crazy.
Robert Siegel, you got your start professionally writing for and then editing the satirical news magazine, The Onion.
Yes.
You're not writing film comedies. Neither The Wrestler nor your new movie, Big Fan, is a comedy. Are you surprised that you've headed in a darker direction instead of comedy?
Not really. I see it as consistent. The Onion and The Wrestler and now Big Fan are all kind of on the same continuum. They're just on opposite ends of it. They're all blends of comedy and tragedy. It's just a matter of the ratio. The Onion, I would say, is maybe 90% comedy, 10% tragedy. And The Wrestler maybe is the reverse, 90% tragedy, 10% comedy. But everything I've done is kind of a mix of the two. I think The Onion has this – is funny, but it's got this strong undercurrent of sadness. And I think Big Fan and The Wrestler are both sad with strong undercurrents of humor.
I want to play a scene from the film. And I think this is a really good scene in showing the main character's relationship with his mother. He's 35 years old, but, you know, he lives with his mother. In his bedroom, his bed, it has a bedspread that has the names of all the sports teams on it. I mean, that's the emotional level that he's still at. It's kind
of
like having a Star Wars,
eBay,
bedspread or something.
But, oh, yeah.
But anyway, so his mother... he still has to respect a lot of his mother's rules about what to do in the house, and he feels very much under her thumb, but he doesn't know how to get out and be an independent person yet. So here they are, the mother and the son, driving home from Paul's nephew's birthday party. And at the party, his brother-in-law has offered him a job at Price Club, but he doesn't want to do that. He just wants to stay work in his garage, and he's really offended by the pressure of him to take another job. So here he is with his mother in the car driving home. And his mother is played by Marcia Jean Kurtz, and of course Paul is played by my guest Patton Oswalt.
What do you have against Price Club?
I'd rather not discuss my career.
You have a career? It's news to me. You could actually go somewhere at Price Club.
Yeah, like Dennis, please.
He's doing extremely well for himself. Who knows? He could probably meet somebody.
What does that mean?
Your brother and sister both found people at work.
Yeah, Gina was Jeff's secretary. He cheated on his wife with her.
It's a lot better for him than that louse Roberta.
He's a cheat. He f***ed her while he was still married.
Don't say that word in my car.
Which one, f*** or cheat?
You know. That language in my car.
Oh, so it's worse for me to say it than for him to do it.
Cut it out, Paul. You should only meet somebody as good as Gina.
Oh, boy, that'll be tough to top.
Yeah, for you?
Yeah, give me about an hour.
You have to actually date someone to top it.
I date?
Oh, sure. You're dating lots of girls.
You don't think I date?
I know exactly who you date. Your hand.
What did you just say?
Okay. So that was... my guest, Patton Oswalt, with Marcia Jean Kurtz in a scene from Big Fan, which was written and directed by my guest, Robert Siegel. Patton Oswalt, what did you tap into to get into this character's loneliness and frustration and sense of isolation?
As far as those were concerned, I kind of tapped into a lot of the, Robert talked about listening to a lot of sports radio. I listened to stuff like Art Bell and Best Show on WFMU with Tom Sharpling, where they are these sort of fringe magnets where these people call in and they're so odd and weird but clearly happy in their oddness that you realize that it only looks like loneliness from the outside. So I didn't play Paul as this yearning, lonely guy. I played him as a guy who in his mind he thinks it's all settled, it's perfect. And it's up to people that are watching him. I didn't judge him at all because the script didn't judge him. So as far as tapping into the loneliness, what I tried to tap into was in his mind his satisfaction with the circumstances of his life and his frustration with pointless exotic trivia and game facts and things like that, which I think that's what kind of brings out the sadness. And if you look at him, and also the scene that you just played and the other ones that I have with that actress plays my mom, Marcia Jean Kurtz. She was so amazing. There's another scene where we really have a knockdown, drag out screaming match, and she was so amazing in those scenes that she was just so good at bringing out the frustration, and that there's almost an edge of fear in my voice in those scenes, because this is the one person that can get to me and maybe try to pull me out into the world, and I don't want it happening. So, and she was in stuff like Panic in Needle Park and Dog Day Afternoon, so she was there for a lot of that early 70s New Hollywood, and it's just so good at working with other actors that, you know, those are the scenes I improvise the most.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah, because she just constantly kept me off guard, because she was so, you know, her readings were – she just chose to be so blunt and totally straightforward in those scenes.
In a way that mothers often feel privileged too.
Oh, totally, yeah. Yeah. There's no easing up to the hard revelation she's given me. It's just, boom, you need a girlfriend. You need a better job. Your life is horrible. And I'm under attack all of a sudden.
Robert Siegel, you wrote in some details for the mother that I think are so perfect. Like, she saves all the duck sauce and soy sauce packets from Chinese takeout food in Ziploc bags. And she has, like, bags and bags and bags of them. I've seen that so much.
I had no idea how many people would relate to that.
Oh, I've seen so much of that.
Save those duck sauce packets.
Yeah, and then you have her – there's a phone answering tape that she has, like, for her answering machine. And it's so perfect. It's the kind of message left by someone who believes that no one has ever heard – a voice message before, so they have
people
to be
of a certain age will still they follow the rules.
They have to lay out the rules in really clearly enunciated voice.
Please leave your name, number, and the time you called.
Well, you're trying to bring out that there's some people who leave those messages as if no one's ever heard one before, and
well,
they don't know what to do.
That's the kind that scene required an answering machine outgoing message, and that's the way I imagine she would. Leave it.
The person who plays the sister-in-law in the movie, Seferina Fiore.
Sarah, the great Seferina Fiore, making her acting debut.
Yeah. Now, she apparently worked at a gentleman's club when you were making The Wrestler,
she continues to advise you.
She still does.
Yeah, she's the manager of Headquarters, if I may slip in a plug, the finest gentleman's club in all of New York City, located on Manhattan's west side. That's Headquarters.
Bring your NPR card for discounts at for drinks.
Yes, you can redeem your NPR funny money for complimentary drinks and lap dances.
NPR listeners, make sure to drop by Headquarters.
Just mention Terry Gross, and you'll receive an extended two-song dance for the price of one.
Wait, I got to stop you here. Have you guys had lap dances?
In our lives,
during the shoot?
In your lives.
I have had a lap dance in my life, yes.
Singular?
Singular.
I have too.
Yeah.
Was it for research or because you wanted it?
It was for several. There was this period where all my friends were getting married, and it was like a spate o' bachelor parties, and we would and people think that, like, the one thing they really got in the movie about strip clubs is usually in movies they'll show strip clubs as you've got to approach the girls and the guys. The strippers tend to be kind of aggressive about giving you a lap dance because that's how they make money.
Yeah, yeah.
So they are very insistent of, hey, let's get a lap dance now. You're like, oh, sorry, okay. So that aggressiveness was very accurate.
Was there something you wanted to ask me about Seraphina? I love her. I want to give her airtime.
Yeah, well, the reason why I asked about the lap dances is that it figures very prominently in The Wrestler and in Big Fan. So, So I was just
both
really,
of which
really
are part of my strip club trilogy. the third volume of which, that should probably be it.
I guess it won't surprise listeners to know I've never been to one of those clubs, but I always see them, like, in movies and, of course, on The Sopranos and other TV
shows. You've
never
been to a strip club, Terry Gross?
Yeah, big surprise, right? But they always look so creepy to me.
That was the hardest part of the movie for me, was during the beating scene. There's a shot where I had to have my face on the floor, so my face was pressed against the carpeting of a strip club.
Strip club carpeting?
So you tell, they show these outtakes of Jackie Chan getting his head popped open. I give him no sympathy. I had my face pressed to the carpeting of a strip club. I mean, I don't want to hear about these Werner Herzog actors who go through hell in the jungle. you know, put your face against the carpeting at headquarters
Fitzgeraldo's
and get back to me.
Got nothing on.
Yeah, I'll haul a ship up a mountain any day, as long as I don't got to put my face on a carpeting.
So you shot it in a real strip club, I take it?
Yeah, that was shot at headquarters.
Which
is the club where Serafina Fiori, who plays the sister-in-law, where she is the manager.
And what is it also known for?
It's also the club where, coincidentally, Plexico Burress of the New York Giants was the night when he shot himself in the leg.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because there's nothing less dangerous than a gun in a pair of sweatpants. That's super secure. Yeah, put it in your sweatpants. You're good. Brilliant.
Excuse me for two things. I'm just going to go back to the lap dance thing. I just have one more lap dance question for you.
What is it with you, Terry, with the lap dance?
Why don't you just go to a club and find out?
No, I see this all the time in movies and on TVs, and it just seems like it would be the most weird and, in a way, self-conscious experience to be a man having a lap dance. I mean, it just seems so...
I think it depends on the man, because a lot of guys, I think they get – it's that whole thing of, look, everyone's looking at me and this hot girl is on my lap. Who I'm also openly paying for. For me, it has always been very, very creepy because it's very aggressive. Like I can't stress to you how aggressive the getting of the lap dance is. You don't have to do anything. They are – because that's how they make their money. And they're kind of insistent in – almost, may I say, rude about it. So it's always given me the willies.
There are guys who find it creepy and awkward and depressing, and then there are guys who find it there's a naked girl in my lap.
Right. I just feel it because it's so public. I feel like an inbred Roman emperor. Like, what? Look what they brought back from Gaul for me. Now dance, woman. You know,
it just Brazilian.
Feels, yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's just so creepy.
Yeah, it's Croatian.
Yeah, exactly.
And Patton Oswalt, your character in the film, declines.
Well, yeah, because my true love is in the room.
He's just annoyed and distracted by a woman comes to sit on his lap, and he's just vaguely annoyed that she's kind of blocking his view of the football player.
Yeah, with her gourd. Please get your gorgeous naked body out of my way so I can look at the giant guy that's about to pummel me into a coma.
There's a great shot of him kind of peering around the woman to try to see the football player.
I'm peering around a tan and perfect flank so that I can look at Quantrell Bishop.
Well, it's been really fun talking with you both about the new movie, Big Fan. I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Thanks.
Robert Siegel and Patton Oswalt speaking to Terry Gross in 2009. Their film, Big Fan, comes out next week on DVD. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says there's so much good jazz coming out on DVD now, old stuff, new stuff, TV concerts, documentaries, that it's more than anyone can keep up with. But he says a few recent releases really caught his eye and ear.
Music by Bill Frisell from a DVD of three otherwise silent comedies by the amazing Buster Keaton, finally issued with the contemporary soundtracks the guitarist trio recorded in the 90s. Keaton's moves seem as effortless as Fred Astaire's, and he was a wizard at staging complicated mayhem before the camera. In the film One Week, newlyweds build a prefab house from mismatched parts and wind up with an accidental cubist masterpiece that spins on its axis in a high wind. Frisell's music is appropriately jocular and offhandedly complex. Drummer Joey Barron provides the sound effects for scenes of construction and destruction and tracks every on-screen pratfall and double take. Matching the film's beats, the trio attain the same headlong, syncopated momentum as Keaton does. Jazz musicians can be kinetic on screen, too. A new DVD of Anita O'Day, filmed in Scandinavia in 1963 and 70 and released in the Jazz Icons series, is required viewing for anyone who doubts singers are real jazz musicians. Even on stage with two accompanists she'd never met before, O'Day instantly takes charge, yanking the trio ahead and using hand signals to orchestrate a performance on the fly. And she's fantastic at breakneck tempos, sometimes lagging so far behind the band you think she'll never catch up.
Let's fall in love. Why should we fall in love? Our hearts are made of it. Let's take a chance. Why be afraid of it? Let's close our eyes, make our own paradise. Little we know of it, still we can try to make a go of it. We might have been meant for each other to be, or not to be. Let our hearts discover. Let's fall in love. Now is the time for it while we are young. Let's fall in love. Why shouldn't we fall in love? Our hearts are made of it. Let's take a chance. Why be afraid it? Let's close our eyes and make our paradise. Little we know of it's there. We can try to make a go of it.
Anita O'Day, 1963. It's fascinating to hear her tackle some of the same tunes 7 years later. It shows how even diehard improvisers may repeat certain effects and routines for years. Another standout in the Jazz Icons series is a 1964 BBC TV concert by flugelhorn player Art Farmer. His excellent quartet with guitarist Jim Hall play a few tunes they never put out on record, so this DVD is valuable for the music alone. Farmer and Hall are prized for their understated lyricism, and there's some sweet slow stuff. But the up-tempo middle of the set is a barn burner, and it's great to hear the flugelhorn wail. Art Farmer with Pete LaRocca Sims on drums and Steve Swallow on bass. There's nothing quite like the excitement of jazz musicians pushing each other. It's even better when you can see it, as on tenor saxophonist Fred Anderson's DVD, 21st Century Chase, shot last March at his Velvet Lounge in Chicago. Five cameras put you in or close to the action, and if the jumps among multiple angles can get hectic, so can the music. It's loose but decidedly swinging free jazz by three generations of players, spearheaded by tenor sax elders and friendly sparring partners Anderson and Kid Jordan. The saxophonist Fine Rhythm Trio includes guitarist Jeff Parker and drummer Chad Taylor, two terrific players nurtured by Fred Anderson early on. The fretboard close-ups of Parker here and Jim Hall on the Art Farmer DVD are boons to guitarists on the lookout for flatted fifth chords and fresh melodic patterns. As any musicians who ever crowded around a bandstand can tell you, you can learn a lot about music from looking as well as listening.
Kevin Whitehead is a jazz columnist for eMusic.com. Youth in Revolt is a teen sex comedy based on a series of novels by C.D. Payne about an inhibited California teen who will suddenly do anything to land the girl of his dreams. He's played by Michael Cera of Arrested Development, Superbad, and Juno, and the large supporting cast includes Steve Buscemi, Justin Long, Gene Smart, and Ray Liotta. Film critic Dave Edelstein has this review.
Michael Cera might be the least sexually threatening juvenile in the history of sex comedy. He's thin and hairless and has zero muscle tone and a high head voice that an 18th century castrato would have killed for. To avoid projecting hysteria in the face of women he desires, he affects a glassy deadpan. Yet he speaks very fast and with startling precision, as if he hopes his hyper-articulateness will cover for the body he can't control. Cera was touchingly tremulous in Superbad and somewhat inexplicable in Juno, so scared of the heroine's pregnancy he seemed unworthy of her. But in Youth in Revolt, he has his best vehicle. It's a sterling pedestal for his sexual panic. The movie is based on a novel by C.D. Payne called Youth in Revolt, The Journals of Nick Twisp. The name Twisp, T-W-I-S-P, is inspired. It evokes wispy inexperience. In Nick's narration in the film, excerpts from his journal, he tells us he's a virgin, that no female is interested in him, and that having sex is the goal of his life. His divorced mother, played by Gene Smart, has taken up with Zach Galifianakis as a hairy slob truck driver who one day decides they'll take a vacation. And their journey from Oakland to a trailer park in upstate Ukiah is rendered in claymation, one of many whimsical touches that lift Youth in Revolt from the mundane to the surreal. Nick is smitten by the delightful Portia Doubleday as the teasing, equally hyper-articulate Sheeny Saunders, who as Nick applies sunscreen to her exposed flesh and marvels at his physiological response. She has a boyfriend, though, an Adonis and Renaissance man. For a host of reasons, she suggests the wimpy Nick become a bad boy. She finds everything French a turn-on, so Nick concocts a dangerous Frenchy alter ego, played by Cera with a pencil mustache.
My one and only love needs me to be bad. To overcome the inhibitions that compel me to be law-abiding, polite to my elders, and excessively nice, I have decided to create a supplementary persona named Francois Dillinger. Bold, contemptuous of authority, and irresistible to women. Francois is just the type of aggressive sociopath who can wage and win a war of nerves.
There's no escapade in Youth in Revolt you haven't seen before, but no teen sex film has this mix of farce and fever dream. Director Miguel Arteaga keeps the action hurtling forward as Gustin Nash's script piles on crisis after crisis to the brink of absurdism, calamities that Nick leaves behind as his drive to have Sheeny propels him on. He ends up running from police in his undies and at one point a dress. In classic screwball style, his libido both empowers and emasculates him. But when he tells her he'd like to tickle her belly button from the inside, and she gasps in pleasure at his newfound effrontery, the humiliations he has gone through seem worth it. Youth in Revolt is one of several recent films to take coming-of-age comedy to a surreal plane. Superbad was a dark odyssey into the American libido. The neglected Gentleman Broncos, a Mormon study in sexual sublimation. I like this breed of dirty movie. It goes beyond leering, beyond sexism, to the core tension of a culture that ricochets between puritanism and promiscuity. Of course, these are movies made by and about straight males. The hope is that women directors will soon show teenage boys what they're up against, along with the anxieties that, despite la différence, they have in common.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine.